Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is the Brian Lehrer Show podcast. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but everything we do is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
It took them 4 months to come up with a unified proposal, which is what we received last Wednesday night. It took us 4 business days to get back to them.
Developer Larry Silverstein on the World Trade Center redevelopment compromise he agreed to yesterday. As I mentioned before the news, it was almost eerie to follow the local news yesterday afternoon just as Silverstein was agreeing to let the Trade Center site be redeveloped as a mixed-use space. We learned that the legendary guru of mixed-use urbanism and hater of tall towers had died at the age of 89. Jane Jacobs was probably most famous for fighting the power broker Robert Moses and winning, defeating plans to run an expressway through Washington Square back in the 1960s, and for her 1961 book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, which denounced the towers on a plaza architecture that was so popular with planners at the time and advocated a low-rise, mixed-use, high-density approach to revitalizing cities. Here is Jane Jacobs on WNYC in 1962.
I opened the New York Times one morning and found that our own area of the West Village was going to have an urban renewal project in it. So I suddenly had to put into practice my own premises that if anything was going to happen to reverse the way things were being done, the citizens had to take some initiative and the citizens had to frustrate the planners. I thereupon began to devote myself to frustrating planners.
Jane Jacobs, and she did decades of frustrating planners, indeed, speaking on WNYC in 1962, and with me now to talk about the legacy of Jane Jacobs and the capitulation of Larry Silverstein are the New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger and Martin Filler, who writes about architecture for the New York Review of Books and House and Garden. They've both been with us many times before as they follow Ground Zero redevelopment. Hi, Paul. Hi, Martin.
Good morning.
And let's start with Jane Jacobs. The Times obituary this morning, Paul, places the death and life of great American cities in the same league with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, Malcolm X's autobiography, and Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed as seminal works of the 1960s. Does it belong up there?
I think absolutely it does, Brian. I think it's one of the books that changed the world. It's one of those books that didn't just push forward the cutting edge of thinking, it moved the mainstream, it moved the center. Common wisdom became different after Jane Jacobs' book, as it did after Betty Friedan, as it did after Rachel Carson. And that's an extraordinary achievement to move the whole center of thinking in our culture.
The common wisdom moved from what to what?
I think the common wisdom moved from either sympathy for or tolerance of Robert Moses and a kind of top-down view of planning, bulldoze and rebuild view of planning as simply cleaning up messes and putting abstractions there that really were not related to the realities of life, to a much more fine-grained willingness to understand that city life is a complex, organic entity. It depends on a lot of little things. It's often funky, unpredictable, and in the end what you see rather than some abstract theoretical idea counts for a lot more.
Not just what you see, but how you live in it.
Absolutely.
And Martin Jacobs sounded the alarm against the kind of urban renewal projects that were dominant at the time, bulldozing the tenement slums and replacing them with high-rise housing projects built inside big open plazas. And she preferred as we were saying, the short blocks, a mix of old and new buildings, mixed-use development, residential and commercial together. Why did she hate the towers so?
Well, I think she was reacting against the predominant urban development mode of post-war United States and Europe, to a certain degree, devolved from the series of Le Corbusier, and really did not take into account what has been called the vie de quartier, the life of the neighborhood, which she really made her life's cause. Another thing that I think is tremendously important in that linkage of those three remarkable women, not to exclude Malcolm X and others from those seminal 60s writers, is that Jane Jacobs was really a feminist avant la lettre. I mean, a lot of what she had to say about cities, neighborhoods, and urbanism forced a woman's perspective into an argument that had largely excluded them. And at the time, there was a very famous rejoinder to the death and life of Great American Cities in The New Yorker, written by Lewis Mumford, in which he dismissively called it Mother Jacobs' Cures for Urban Cancer. And there was a very dismissive tone, and one of the things he brought out in the article was he thought she had an obsessive fear of danger in the city, that the emphasis that she put on a busy street life, of the eyes on the street, as she called it, verged on the obsessive. But to a woman in the 1960s, that was not unrealistic, and certainly the degree to which crime rates and urban dysfunction only increased in the decade afterwards showed how prescient she actually was.
The Mumford-Jacobs feud was a very interesting one, because, of course, they were both violent opponents of Robert Moses, but each in a different way.
Yes, yes. It was a very interesting thing. I went back and reread the exchanges last night, I think part of it clearly had to do that Mumford did not like a woman stealing his thunder. He was sort of at the end point of his urban career. He, of course, came back in the 1970s with his important book, The Pentagon of Power, which was a more overriding indictment of American society. But he speaks very with a great deal of praise about Jacobs speaking at a Harvard conference, and how she was like a breeze, a breath of fresh air that blew through the stuffy halls of urban planners. But once she started to rear her head and steal his thunder, it was another story.
Absolutely.
So I think there's certainly a large element of the personal. But they certainly had common cause in trying to oppose this idea of bulldoze and build, and the conjunction, the coincidence of her death just at this juncture in the long and unending saga of the Trade Center is quite remarkable.
93.9 AM 820 WNYC.org, as we talk about the urbanist Jane Jacobs, who died yesterday at the age of 89, and we will talk about the latest agreement on how to redevelop the World Trade Center site with New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger and Martin Filler, who writes about architecture for the New York Review of Books and House and Garden. And we can take phone calls on either the latest Ground Zero plan, the death and legacy of Jane Jacobs, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And, you know, it's funny, the Mumford quote that the Times used in their obituary today, calling Jacobs' approach aesthetic Philistinism with
right.
a vengeance.
Yeah.
And Paul, you talk about the crime, or Martin, I guess that was you, talking about the crime in the early 1960s. Today we celebrate the fact that crime has come back down to early 1960s levels. Yeah, so that's a little bit of a reality check.
What Mumford was specifically responding to was her saying a city is not a work of art. And in high dudgeon, he says, well, if that's the case, Florence, Siena, Turin, what are those? And he gets all very huffy about it. The fact is that Mumford was little more interested in aesthetics than Jacobs.
Absolutely right, right, yes.
And he always put a certain social emphasis on his approach to architecture, but the really big sticking point between them was the fact that she rejected the whole premise of the garden city and the whole set of theories that emerged from the so-called English garden planning movement, which was like the holy writ to Mumford.
Right. Mumford believed that the city could be rationally planned. And in fact, Jacobs really didn't accept that notion.
Ah,
she.
That's the essence, isn't it?
I think that really is the essence. I think Jacobs believed that the city is a complex organic stew in a way, and we can guide it, we can direct it, we can support what we know is best in it, but it connects much more to the idiosyncrasies of human life.
And not only couldn't be, but is better off not being
centrally
planned. Although, Paul, you're mentioned in that New York Times obit today in the context of even Paul Goldberger has sometimes disagreed with Jane Jacobs, saying sometimes big towers work just fine.
Absolutely. Jane Jacobs, both Jacobs and Mumford in their own ways took issue with something like, say, Stuyvesant Town in Manhattan. Because it didn't fit either of their models. And in fact, in the end, that has turned out to be a remarkably healthy place.
Yes, it was seen as the sort of first evil spawn of Corbusier to take root in the state.
That's right, that's
but
right.
But in fact, the landscaping, which people rarely talk about, in Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper, was done by this remarkable woman and a close associate of Mumford's called Marjorie Sewell Cautley. And today, it's I love driving by on the FDR Drive and seeing those signs that say luxury housing.
So yes.
Things go, times change.
Let's
well,
time,
and 40 or 50 years of tree growth count
right,
for a lot, too.
For a lot.
Let's take some calls. Tom in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. You're an architect, Tom?
I'm an architect, and I think you're wrong to say that Jane Jacobs hated towers. I don't think she hated the Empire State Building. I don't think she hated Rockefeller Center. I think what she hated was the open space. She has a passage in her book about a public housing project where the people feel a tremendous anger about a piece of lawn.
Yes.
About a piece of lawn? Why?
About a piece of lawn. Because she felt that this piece of lawn was being offered to the occupants as some kind of panacea, and that it really didn't interest them. I mean, the life of a city depends upon a street and not on large plazas.
Tom, thank you.
She hated useless open space, I think, that existed only to glorify a tower. That's true.
So it was not the towers, but the towers in the plaza as a whole.
Generally, that was correct. And she certainly believed in the street more than anything else. I think if there was any lesson she taught us, it was that in cities, streets are more important than buildings.
And neighborhoods most important.
Right, right.
And I think the timing of her death, and I hope the degree to which it will bring people back to reading some of her still very pertinent works, will raise some issues about current schemes, such as the current redevelopment plans for Brooklyn, which I think get very much to the heart of what she was about.
And we will get into that as we continue. But John in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, I'm an architect, and like everyone else, I celebrate the liberal city planning life of streets, Jane Jacobs, but also the less talked about, say, libertarian Cato Institute, Jane Jacobs, and her comparison of Manchester and Birmingham in The Economy of Cities, her next great book, where she totally predicts Silicon Valley and understands where the that kind of an economy works, and her brilliant works in the circulation, reflow of money in an economy, et cetera, et cetera.
How do you mean she predicted Silicon Valley?
That Manchester was planned to be the most efficient textile company in the city in the world, and it was from the day it was built, it's been in an economic depression ever since. Birmingham was totally unplanned, tiny little shops interplaying with each other, making guns and then using that tubes to make bicycles and then making motorcycles and then making cars, with all these little shops with spontaneous economic growth rather than planned growth. And it's exactly that kind of organic interrelationship that exploded in Silicon Valley. And she did that.
John, thank you. We're going to take a break. We'll continue with Paul Goldberger and Martin Filler on both the legacy of Jane Jacobs and the latest World Trade Center redevelopment agreement struck yesterday by the powers that be around the Port Authority and developer Larry Silverstein. We will get into the Brooklyn Project and what Jane Jacobs may have thought or did think about some of the other current land use controversies in New York City. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer at WNYC.
This is about moving the rebuilding forward as quickly as possible. All the finger-pointing must stop, and we must all work together to achieve our vital mission.
Developer Larry Silverstein talking about the compromise at his news conference yesterday. And here's a little more of Jane Jacobs speaking on WNYC in 1962, talking about developers and planners generally.
Why, for instance, weren't people walking in the areas that all the artist conceptions had shown full of happy promenaders? They weren't there. Why did stores that looked very cheerful and were supposed to be doing a great booming business in the plans languish? Well, I would bring these questions up with the people who had been responsible for the planning and building of these places, and I couldn't get them very interested in these questions. I got instead quite a lot of alibis, mainly boiling down to people are stupid. They don't do what they're supposed to do.
So we'll keep talking about Jane Jacobs' legacy and the new compromise on the World Trade Center site with New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger and Martin Filler, who writes about architecture for the New York Review of Books and House and Garden. And Paul, what do you think about this deal that was struck yesterday between Silverstein and the Port Authority? To go over some of the basics, as I gather them, he finally agreed to give up control of the Freedom Tower as well as Tower 5, which is now expected to be used for housing. In exchange, he still gets to develop the three other towers that are considered most likely to be profitable, and the government agreed to guarantee that they'll find tenants for lots of the space. What's important about this deal?
Well, it's all too little too late, I think. It's a patchwork done to cover up for the fact that what should have happened was an entirely clean slate on September the 12th, 2001. That didn't happen. The governor made the, I think, horrendous error that the path of least resistance was to keep Silverstein and the Port Authority in place and let them redevelop the site with pretty much the same program it had already had, which is to say vast amounts of unnecessary office space plus the token addition of a memorial and some cultural buildings. That has turned out to have been not the path of least resistance at all, the path of greatest resistance, as well as probably, as well as rather wrong on a moral and symbolic level as well. This is now a modest attempt to try to backpedal a little bit and take semi-public control of the Freedom Tower, but it doesn't get us around the fact that the Freedom Tower is itself a bad design for an unnecessary building.
And here's Mayor Bloomberg speaking after the deal was struck yesterday, sounding, for someone who is a party to a deal that you would think he would want to trumpet as a grand success, sounding a little bit more like you, Paul, than one might expect.
There just comes a time in every negotiation when you say, enough. We've all listened to each other. We've all moved. We all know that the time is now, and you stop the negotiating and you're doing it.
So, Martin Filler, that doesn't sound like this is a fabulous plan. It's the optimum use of the space for all time future.
Well, no. I mean, I think with this deal, Larry Silverstein cements his lasting reputation as, shall we say, the Brer Rabbit of real estate developers. I mean, he really, really had them over a barrel. And whatever noun of derision you might want to choose and attach to him, the one thing the man is not is a fool. And, he knew that if he was left holding the Freedom Tower, it's, I can imagine him saying it's going to lay there like a lox, and it would have, And it was, he knew ultimately that the thing that really amuses me in the Daily News this morning, the headline that says Larry blinks. Okay, if that's blinking, Let me in on the deal. Clearly Bloomberg was frustrated. I like the degree to which he doesn't, try to hide his feelings in polite language. He was really very much testier, in fact, weeks ago with his characterizations of Silverstein. And yes, it's a patchwork. It's a compromise. And but what interests me too is, another one of the great tenets of Jane Jacobs is this idea of the slow organic growth of the most successful urbanism. And because of the tremendous rush that was placed on the development of this huge site, you know, huge in terms of money, in terms of focus of world attention, in terms of area. I do think that was one of the fatal mistakes right from the beginning. You know, we have to rebuild, we have to rebuild quickly, and if we don't, the terrorists will have won. And I think it was, you know, a component that that added to many of these really disastrous decisions all the way.
So let me get your reactions to this pro-Silverstein editorial in the New York Post this morning. It says, indeed, there's reason to believe the talks are only first beginning. Let's face it, it says. The Port Authority's offer, tendered in the names of Governors Pataki and John Corzine and indirectly Mayor Bloomberg, is far too vague to be taken at face value. Frankly, it seems to be just another attempt to strip Silverstein of his legal rights and force him from the project. In one blatantly unfair clause, for example, the Port Authority refuses to grant Silverstein any refund for the $501 million in rent he's paid since 9/11, even though that rent assumed he'd rebuild and control all 10 million square feet of the lost space instead of the roughly 6 million square feet he'll control under the New Deal. So what do you think about that in terms of his rights and about the characterization of this as so vague that the negotiating really isn't over?
Well, I think it is vague to the extent that you look at the map of the development site in the Daily News this morning, and you know these other buildings aren't going to get built. Some of them maybe, you know, but you know, we get back to really one of the major flaws of the original Trade Center, which was there were no tenants, and it was Governor Nelson Rockefeller bailing out his brother David Rockefeller by putting government offices in there, and
of course is precisely what we're about to see again.
Yeah, so we're reliving that worst part.
Right. This is really an extraordinary story of history repeating itself. The world's tallest building goes up on this particular piece of land, pushed very hard by a Republican governor who is determined to do it even though there is no market for the building, and tells us we can put government offices in if there are no commercial tenants. It's like we've sort of seen that movie before.
Absolutely. And, of course, it gets back to there being so many stakeholders, individual and groups, at this site. Silverstein is the leaseholder, the Port Authority is the owner, Governor Pataki for his legacy and political future, the other residents of the neighborhood, the families of the 9/11 victims, not to mention the taxpayers.
Yeah.
But New York and New Jersey, that is, these politicians, wanted the deal, we keep hearing, because they were afraid that Silverstein would run out of money to develop the whole thing, take a huge profit, and walk away from an unfinished ground zero.
Yes.
But what about this government guarantee to find tenants or to move government offices in themselves? Why, and it's almost a Jane Jacobs kind of question, this too, why would the state do any better than Silverstein at being a real estate broker?
It wouldn't at all, but this is sort of like playing bad catch-up ball very, very late in the game, and I think a lot of the really awful decisions and, in fact, derelictions of decision-making that Governor Pataki made all along the way, I think he's the major culprit of the piece in many respects. And
I think no
respect for Larry Silverstein, and it's been very, very amusing watching him take on these various personas of healer of the nation and
victim.
He's been very good at playing victim.
Yeah, so it's I think this is a remarkably fortunate deal for him. Yes, absolutely at stake, and most of this is not going to happen.
But remember, Silverstein has been, despite all of the charades that surrounded him, he's behaved pretty much as a real estate developer is supposed to behave, which is to say, looking out for his own interests.
Oh, yeah.
The governor, on the other hand, is supposed to be looking out for all of our interests, and he has failed at that completely.
Yeah, well, it was very big, you know, his sort of fits and starts agenda on this was very closely tailored to his own political ambitions.
And, yes.
That was really one of the great tragedies, and this phantom that he has of his national political future makes it all even more comic.
This is 93.9 and AM 820, WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer talking with New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger and Martin Filler, who writes about architecture for the New York Review of Books and House and Garden, both about the future of Ground Zero after yesterday's deal between Larry Silverstein and the Port Authority, and the legacy of the urbanist Jane Jacobs, who died yesterday. And our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, for you to join the conversation. And Rose in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rose.
Hi, Brian. I would like to talk about Brooklyn, about Atlantic Yards, because it seems to me that Jane Jacobs' legacy is really being trashed in Brooklyn. I've read about suburban communities who are now trying to develop like cities with organic neighborhoods, with people walking. Mm-hmm. And in Atlantic Yards, what would happen if the development went up as planned is that neighborhoods would be separated from each other and they would not be able to cross through there. It's totally an enclave that's kind of plunked down in the middle of everything, so that Fort Greene would be cut off from Prospect Heights. Both of them would be cut off from Borum Hill and Park Slope. And it would be totally inorganic and just totally foreign.
Paul, do you know if Jane Jacobs actually commented on that program before she died?
I do not know. It would be fascinating to know about that, actually. Obviously, one would assume that she would not have been enthusiastic about it. On the other hand, she also had a fascinating way of sometimes confounding all of us by looking at things freshly. One thing that I know Jane Jacobs did not like and was rather impatient with was the kind of reflexive, formulaic application of her ideas. She and I once talked about that whole trend of replacement of huge suburban covered shopping malls with these sort of new pseudo-village places with fake streets that all sort of pretend to be little ersatz villages, which one might think of as a way in which some of her ideas have actually percolated into the commercial mainstream, and indeed they were that. But she was rightly offended by the fakery of it, by the pretense and the utter disingenuousness of it. I think disingenuousness in urban planning and urban design offended her most of all. And whether she would have felt that Brooklyn was another example of disingenuousness raised to a high scale, or something that had the sort of inherent quality of its own that she might have respected, would have been very interesting to know, actually, and I don't know that she ever spoke out on it.
Even though, Martin, it's a bunch of high-rises down there, and it cuts off neighborhoods in the way that Rose says, it is mixed use in a certain sense, because it's an arena.
I love the way you started.
An arena and residential development for various income levels, as well as the office towers and commercial space. Could it have been something she would be drawn to on that basis?
I really, really seriously doubt it. I mean, I think the neighborhoods, the overlapping areas that the Atlantic Yards project comprises, is a textbook example of that kind of pre-gentrified
right.
New York of old. Yes, there are parts that include some very expensive townhouses. Even that part of Brooklyn has not been immune from the insane rise of real estate values, residential real estate values, particularly in New York. But what is appalling about the scheme is the fact that I think the city has kind of, you know, rolled over and played dead on the kind of redlining, as it were, of what gets to stay and what gets to go. And I did not see sufficient attention being paid to the low-income residents of the neighborhood. And furthermore, even if you find them another place to live, it doesn't have that wonderful, energizing sense of mixtures of people of diverse incomes living in close proximity.
Susan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thank you. Your panel gives me an opportunity to share something that has always stayed with me about the World Trade Center, which was, I was walking by there late at night once, or sort of after hours, 8 to 9 p.m. The original Trade Center. And there was, it was like a moonscape, or, you know, at the ground level all around it. And there was a man who obviously had worked there, was on his way home, and he was reading a book the whole time he walked by. Like, there was just nothing to relate to. And so I would certainly hope whatever replaces it has, you know, the street life that you're talking about. And I just also wanted to share about Times Square, how awful I think it is compared to, in reference to the Manchester-Birmingham analogy you were making, where all the little wig shops and the tap dance studios and all the things you would look up at the second and third floor level as you went by, knowing that all the Broadway gypsies were up there getting ready to be in the shows that were downstairs. I mean, it's just all gone. It's just, to me, it's a moonscape also.
Susan, thank you. Although later in the week, we're going to have the social critic Marshall Berman, who just wrote a book about Times Square. And one of the things that he writes is that he doesn't hate the new Times Square as much as he expected to. Now, yes,
right,
that's
right.
Faint praise.
Yeah.
But what he says is that it does actually have a kind of, you know, a street life that feels like street life. Did Jane Martin, to your knowledge, ever talk about that?
Well, to me, the street life of Times Square reminds me very much now of that around Leicester Square in London. You know, you emerge from a taxi or a subway if you're going to the theater or dinner, and there are these hordes of young people in bright lights, and I don't know where they're going. I don't know how late their evening is going to be, but it has, you know, there's a lot of traffic, and it's thrilling in a way, but
right,
quite different from what the old Times Square, you know, used to be. But, I mean, I think, you know, look, she also, God bless her, I mean, I think she made a really important contribution in her insistence on the, you know, the indivisible nature of the neighborhood as the basic building block of cities. On the other hand, she did have a tendency to romanticize. We all can't live in Greenwich Villages.
Right.
Economies change. The nature of work has changed so much since the days of Mumford and Jacobs that anything they said is really outdated by developments that they could never have anticipated. But
her city was a city that had a significant manufacturing economy as a component to it, and that is no longer the case.
Yeah, we forget that Soho.
Many of the reshaping of Times Square, paradoxically, is in fact in part a function of the reshaping of New York into almost entirely a service economy.
Mm-hmm.
We're almost out of time. We have about 2 minutes left, and I think we should remember, too, that Jane Jacobs was not just an author and a thinker. She was a real activist. She was part of a group that rushed the podium at a city planning commission hearing on Greenwich Village, her neighborhood. She was arrested after disrupting another meeting about that Robert Moses
Expressway.
Right. I mean, it is amazing today. And, you know, I wasn't around for that debate, but it's amazing to think that they were thinking of putting an expressway through Washington Square.
Well, that, more than any other thing, tells you how far we've come. That the Lower Manhattan Expressway, which would have destroyed Soho, is an unthinkable thing that only really a little more than one generation ago, 40 years ago, was a very real idea that was either tolerated or enthusiastically promoted by an awful lot of people who we would consider respectable parts of the liberal mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yes, including the editorial page of the New York Times.
Yes, absolutely right. Yes. Absolutely right.
And she also moved her family to Toronto during the Vietnam War after her son said he would go to jail rather than fight if he were drafted.
But she also found one of the most livable cities in the Western Hemisphere as well, and did remarkable work up there also. And the press coverage, the obituaries from the Canadian press this morning are just ecstatic in terms of their gratitude that they were the beneficiary of New York.
Toronto
became the holy mother of Toronto.
Did she? Toronto is seen so much as kind of a model of progressive 21st century urbanism in its design. Was she responsible? We just have 20 seconds, but Paul, was she responsible for any of that?
I think she became really the celebrator of it more than the creator of it. She became Toronto's sort of patron saint more than its begetter. But by her patronage and by her support, Toronto, I think, became even more celebrated as a kind of urban model. Yeah.
Paul Goldberger writes about architecture for The New Yorker. Martin Filler writes about architecture for The New York Review of Books and House and Garden. Thank you both very much for coming on this day of all days. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.